Welcome to everybody. Thank you for being here. We appreciate it. I'm Elizabeth Schneider, Vice President for State Advocacy and Outreach with the Alliance for Excellent Education, currently serving as Interim VP for Policy. As I trust most of you know, the Alliance is a nonprofit advocacy and policy organization here in town. Its mission is to ensure that all students graduate from high school prepared for success in college, work, and life. Our particular focus is on the 6 million students who are most at risk, and our goal is to strengthen federal policy to ensure that they have better odds. This has been widely reported in the press. We face a significant graduation crisis in our country, with 3 out of 7 students failing to graduate from high school, and almost 1 in 2 African-American and Hispanic students failing to graduate. In a world where 90% of jobs in the fastest growing sectors of the economy require some post-secondary training or education, a failure to address this crisis is a recipe for long-term economic trouble for our country. From a federal policy point of view, we have really failed to positively impact this crisis, in particular by not holding schools and districts accountable on high school graduation rates. Luckily, with new regulations, hopefully supported and strengthened by legislation that's been introduced in this Congress, we will soon have accurate statistics and a clear picture of just which students we're failing to serve. The good news is that while this crisis has been brewing, in the absence of accurate statistics, there have been dedicated teachers, administrators, mentors, and community leaders that have been working to support the needs of at-risk students, to understand them, and to make sure that they realize success. It is important to spotlight and to highlight the fact that there are recuperative models that exist, that there are replicable solutions to address the dropout crisis, and that's our reason for being here today. While politicians of all stripes have long been focused on the need to support at-risk students, we feel like we're at a particular moment of opportunity at the federal level right now, with a president who is very outspoken about the value of education and helping him achieve success in life, and also with the Secretary of Education who's so keenly attuned to the needs of at-risk students from having grown up in Chicago and worked in the inner city of Chicago as well. It is very important that policymakers understand the hunger that exists in districts across the country for models like we will discuss today, the performance learning centers, that they familiarize themselves with how these types of models work and understand the serious evaluation under which they have gone. We're so pleased today to have with us 4 representatives from communities and schools, a 30-year-old organization based in Georgia that has been working to support students for decades. Because of their deep knowledge and work around with students, communities and schools has always emphasized the fact that students need not only academic support, but social and personal support, recognizing the full range of challenges that can throw them off track. Communities and schools really was the first organization that I'm aware of to articulate 5 basic principles or promises that students need in order to succeed. And we have, so many of us, America's Promise, the Alliance, and others, have continued to draw on that very accurate and rich description, prescription for student success for years. We're here today in particular to learn about the Performance Learning Centers, which is an evolution of the CIS work. It's a model that they developed in 2002 with two pilot sites. And it has grown now to represent 35 schools in 6 states. It's my pleasure to introduce Colonel Reginald Beattie here, who is a product of one of CIS's street schools, who went on to successfully have a career of over 20 years in the U.S. Army, and who has been back at CIS and directing the Performance Learning Center expansion for the past several years. He is joined here by Anita Cullen, who's the academic coordinator for the Douglas County Performance Learning Center in Georgia, as well as by Cami Hunt, a 2008 graduate of that school. We're also very pleased to have here Gary Chapman, Deputy Vice President for Field Operations with CIS, who helps to manage 14 state offices, 200 affiliates, representing 1.2 million students. So we'll ask the four of them to speak, and then I will introduce Philip for a response. Thank you very much.
Again, good morning.
The
first thing I want to say is, I know in some on the agenda that you have, it has kernel, and you see the word alternative. Let me just say that those two have absolutely nothing to do, or they don't go together when we talk about performance learning centers, because when I travel and we talk about performance learning centers and I get introduced as kernel, people think, well, is this some boot camp? Is it some punitive initiative? Let me just say, no, it's not. Again, on behalf of communities and schools, I want to say thank you for this opportunity to talk about what we consider our most precious resource, and that is our young people, particularly those that are underrepresented, those that are underserved, those that are not achieving, and what we call this 21st century world of ours, but yet there are so many young people that are not able to put themselves in a position, and should they have a life sentence because they made some choices or because of an environment, choices have been made for them that they're not successful. And so what I want to do is just talk a little bit about communities and schools, because it is the foundation of our work. And yes, our mission is to connect those community resources. And as we talk through this, think about the name, literally, community in schools. Because schools alone cannot deal with some of the challenges that we're facing or some of the challenges that our kids are facing. Because if teaching is happening, but yet teachers are dealing with the reluctant learner or the at-risk student, and you're dealing with gangs and drugs and all these other issues, then yet, how can we expect teachers to focus on the rigor of education and make it relevant to a young child? And so community schools take a community approach, and that is if we can help young people successfully learn, stay in school, and then ultimately prepare for life. Because you can't get a child turned on to learning till you get them turned on to living. And yet, many of us may come from environments or situations where we have parents and other support structures that provides these five basics. And if you look at these five basics, I would like for anyone to tell me why any young person who's been successful then at least at some time have some of these five basics in their life. But yet there are a lot of young people that are going to school every day, and we presuppose that yes, maybe they didn't get a chance to choose who their parents are. They didn't get a chance to choose the environment. And we believe all parents really love their kids, but yet sometimes people are faced with environments, they don't get a chance to have that one-on-one relationship with a caring adult. And if I'm not in an environment where I have a safe place to learn and grow, then it's going to be very difficult for me to have that healthy start, healthy future, because I'm probably going to make some choices in the short term because I'm living for today that maybe I'm not thinking about tomorrow. Because I don't think any young person walks out their door and say, you know, this economy requires that everyone has at least two or more years of post-secondary education, but yet I'm going to drop out of school tomorrow. I don't think any young person critically goes through a critical thinking process and think that way. And so community schools believe that if we can give a young person a marketable skill upon graduation, then they're going to come back to give to their community. We are the nation's leading dropout prevention organization, or the largest dropout prevention organization in the country, and you can see what we do. We literally work in the schools. Because the schools do not create, nor can they have the capacity to deal with all of the community challenges. And I'll show you some of those risk factors that schools are not equipped and don't have the capacity to take on. But if we can coordinate all the resources, because if the challenges are in the community, the solutions are in the community. So if we can take a community approach and not use blame and throw stones at teachers and educators, but let's look at this, that we're all in this together, and if we take that approach, then we can see more students who will stay in school and ultimately prepare for life and go on and have a successful life. Essentially, when we think about the dropout epidemic, and Elizabeth talked about half of minority students are not graduating from school. And what we call that, essentially, if you're so far stuck in the game, and G-A-M-E in this case, as young people would talk about the game and being stuck, and we think of someone that's stuck and they can't get out of that, and you already know that half of black and Hispanic kids are not graduating from high school, we also know that if it's true that the number one reason why young ladies are dropping out of school is because of teen pregnancy, if we know that young people are making choices, and if you retain one time, there's a 27% likelihood that you won't graduate from high school. If you retain twice, there's a 54% likelihood. And if you retain three times, there's a 100% likelihood that you won't graduate from high school. So when we were thinking through that, we think, wow, young people and the consequences, and we know, yes, it may not happen in our own lives, in our own houses, but the impact, when we look at incarceration and the penalty of being dependent on the system, on the government, the cost of billions of dollars, but yet we say we are a caring country, and young people are making choices, and not always wise choices, but if we can get them to think critically about their decisions, and you hear one story today because we truly believe that the data that you're going to see, the information that you're going to receive, it will educate, but the stories will truly inspire us. And that's the perspective that communities and schools take. Yes, research-based, we know data, we need to make data-driven decisions, but the personal touch from young people telling you about their stories and how it's impacted their lives to include, not as young, to include the person that's up here before you who's also benefited from this organization as a student himself. Let's look at these barriers. When we think about school, when you think about drugs and alcohol and violence and low self-esteem and unemployment and negative peer pressure, teachers at universities and principals at universities are going to school to teach, to teach, to teach. They're learning at universities to teach. But yet we're asking schools to deal with all these community-related challenges, and schools don't have the capacity, nor should they be required to take on, because if schools and teachers and principals are dealing with these external factors that didn't happen in the school. Nothing up here says that it's a responsibility through math, English, science, and social studies to deal with alcohol, violence, medical problems, dental problems, and all these other challenges. So if we're asking teachers to teach, but yet they don't have the capacity to deal with all these issues that ultimately can impact on teaching and learning, then there has to be some other way of addressing those challenges, because we have wonderful teachers, but yet we still have one-third of our students not graduating from various high schools around the country. But yet we're asking that young person who's bringing all of that to school. Imagine a young person who's bringing low self-esteem, parents unemployed, doesn't have any medical benefits, coming to school with a dental, with a teeth ache, a toothache. But yet we're asking that young person, you know, we want you to go in here and focus on chemistry. We want you to go. We couldn't do it as adults. But yet, students are bringing all these barriers to school, and these are barriers that are getting in the way of success, or in this case, school and life, but yet schools by themselves are not equipped to deal with them. There's a lot of effective strategies in the classroom, in traditional educators, in traditional education, and yes, the classroom. We know the pedagogy, teachers dealing with curriculum, we know that. And the governance, and we know education management is there from superintendents and school boards. But yet, when we think about public education, there's still something missing. And what we believe is that, for some reason, one-third of our students are still dropping out. So what's missing? We're not saying this is the silver bullet, but if we don't take an approach that we make this, and the foundation of this is a community perspective, because schools didn't create all of these external barriers, nor should they get all the blame or responsibility for dealing with them. So we're having challenges with parents and families, and if we're dealing with human sacrifices and people who need more human services, whether you're talking about dental health or if you're homeless, those things happen outside of the school, but yet they're brought to the school. And so the foundation of our work of communities and schools is that We know that schools cannot succeed without the community. Thus the name, Community in Schools. So why wouldn't we bring the community in the school to deal with the challenges that our kids are facing? Even though we have this red building over here that looks like a school, and we have all these other resources outside, we know that these things exist in the community, but yet they're not strategically aligned, or in this case, they're fragmented. And if they're fragmented, a teacher can't get on the phone and say, you know, I really think I need a mentor to help this young person. Because if I'm on the phone doing that, then who's in the classroom teaching? If a principal realizes, you know, I really need someone to come over here and help me with these external issues that are facing this young person who's been put out of their home and now they're homeless. If a principal is doing that, then who's managing the school? And so we know that there are resources out in the community. It takes an organization to come in and refocus and align those resources and take a bullseye approach. Because we just can't throw a program at every student in every school and say, you know, let's see if this hits the right person. No, it needs to be tailored with a bullseye approach that we're addressing the individual needs of each student. And thus, a coordinated way, ultimately, the bottom line. People are saying, well, these are social issues. No, these are very much social as well as academic issues, because if we don't deal with those things, then we're not going to improve attendance, behavior, and ultimately, we're not going to improve academic performance, and we'll continue to leave children behind, and we will not make AYP, and schools will continue to not make AYP because we're not addressing all those other external factors. And for most of us in this room, maybe our kids are coming to school ready to learn. And we have a system that presupposes that every child is coming to school ready to learn. But we know that's not true. For the most part, two-thirds, depending on which state or system, maybe higher, are coming to school ready to learn. But what about the reluctant learner that's bringing all those various risk factors? Because ultimately, if we deal with those issues, then we'll see higher stay in school rates and higher graduation rates to up and get kids ready for life. And now as I switch over and talk about the initiative, the Performance Learning Center, because the basis of those few slides that I talked about earlier was the foundation of the Performance Learning Center. It's one of our signature initiatives within communities and schools. Well, I'm showing here, and you can see I only went to the class of 2002. I'm going back in the history when we first started the Performance Learning Center. I asked our evaluation manager to tell me in our state in Georgia, tell me how many ninth graders start the ninth grade every year. It was 100,000, roughly about 100,000 ninth graders. Well, you see 123 freshmen. And that is because 20,000 of the previous class were retained every year. And as I mentioned, if we have 100,000 eighth graders going to the ninth grade, we have 100,000 ninth graders and 20,000 are retained, we start off every year with 120,000 ninth graders. 4 years later, when it's time for that same class to show up for the 12th grade, you can see we've lost roughly 40%. The classes are 40% smaller. So where are those students? As I went out to districts, I told them, you know, these students, if you know where Georgia is, those have been down south, you know we're surrounded by Florida, Alabama, North Carolina, and South Carolina. And when I went to the districts, we said, you know, these students aren't moving to these other states. They're here. So what happened from the time they left the eighth grade, went to the ninth grade? 27%, in this case, as I mentioned, if a student's retained one time, there's a 27% likelihood that that child wouldn't graduate from high school. So we realized three classes, the class of 2000, 2001, and 2002, were essentially 40% smaller. So where are those students? They're hanging out. They're doing other things, all the things that I showed you earlier. And so if we know that, and we know schools in a traditional sense are not ready to deal with the overage, unaccredited student, then we need some other intervention that's going to help deal with the population of kids that we're talking about. Well, in the 90s, we went to Governor Azell Miller at the time, And we asked to start these alternative schools. Well, what we started and what we helped get started was something that we were not necessarily proud of. And that was alternative punitive schools, or what we call crossroads. And that's what they're truly disrupted. But what about the students who made some choices early on in the ninth grade that didn't value education, that didn't come to school ready to learn? What about the population that maybe they've been expelled, maybe they've had some behavior challenges, but now the maturation process has set in and they've said to themselves, you know, I want to go on and do something with my life. Well, we didn't have options necessarily throughout the state of Georgia. So that was the premise of us starting the Performance Learning Center. And so I went to the superintendent and I said, I tell you what, we have a great deal for you. Give us a student that meets all of these risk factors that we know in a traditional setting, they're not necessarily succeeding. If a student is chronically late, and those are the students we know they're not turning on their education, let us have those students. Students who've been experienced 30 or plus days of absences from school. Students just reluctant, not turned on to school, whatever reason, has the capacity, ability, or they're just demonstrating some poor academic achievement because they're not turned on education, but has the ability, but yet have failed, whatever the reasons may be. And as I mentioned earlier, give us a young lady, because a lot of students have told us, and a lot of our young ladies have told us, you know, if I stay out of school, I don't want to go back to the traditional school because I'm embarrassed, or whatever the reasons may be. So whether these are true or they're perceived, but yet in the minds of the young folks that we interviewed, these were true risk factors in their minds or behaviors. And we said, you know, to superintendents and districts, give us those students, as long as they have a basic reading, math, competency level of an eighth grade. And we, in some cases, we said 6.5. But basic reading, math, competency level, because if we get them, we believe we can turn them on to living and then ultimately transform them to really understanding what's in it for me, the WIFM, and why education is so important, as opposed to looking at it just from a cognitive perspective. And when we think cognitive, we know that, yes, we typically measure students by testing and these other standardized tests, and we're believers. We need to continue to do that. We still do that. Because all of our students at the Performance Learning Center must meet any criteria, any standard, as any other student in the school system. Same rigorous requirement. But yet, our students, for whatever reasons, were having challenges with the non-academic that I talked about earlier, as well as some of these non-cognitive challenges. That there's short-term gratification. Maybe they don't have that one-on-one relationship with a caring adult. And so if we can deal with adjustments and motivation and perceptions of school and perceptions of themselves first, then we can get young people focused on calculus and all the rigorous courses, chemistry, et cetera, that they need to take. And so Dr. Bill Sedacek said that there are two factors that really cause academic success, and that is the non-cognitive as well as the cognitive. But if all we do is focus on the cognitive challenges, and that is academics for students who are not coming to school ready to learn, then we're going to leave some students behind. And so what we say is, let's deal with the non-academic barriers that I showed earlier, all those risk factors. Then we can have a better chance of causing students to be successful. And so what we did is reverse the strategy. You see rigor from the bottom, productivity over time. We build healthy relationships and cause young people to be turned on to living. And if I ask anybody in this room what caused you to be successful in your life, you probably won't say a math course. You may say a math teacher. You may say a parent, a grandparent. But you're going to say some relationship that caused you to be motivated to do well. And if we can get them motivated and believe in what we're selling, then ultimately we can talk about the relevance of education, then focus on rigor, and then ultimately increase the results. So philosophically, this was how we went in on our very first day of training. We teach teachers and we train teachers. We work through how do you build relationships. Just like you have a lesson plan for curriculum, you need a plan for building relationships. And we need to make sure it's intentional and deliberate. This is the foundation of our PLCs, ultimately keeping young people in school. That's our number one job. Because if the young people who are acting out are put out of school and suspended, then they're the same ones who need to be in school. So we expect them to come back 3 weeks or a month later and catch up. Well, in individualized learning, If you're already behind and you're coming back a month or 2 weeks later, then the chances are you're not going to be successful. So ultimately, develop a marketable skill and then graduate. And this is the foundation of the Performance Learning Center, what we call a three-legged stool. Our language academic coordinator, that's your traditional principal. We have 5 learning facilitators with a 1-15 or 1-18 teacher-to-student ratio. That's just highly trained, highly certified teachers that we're used to talking about. And then the services coordinator. That's that person that's over there coordinating those non-academic kinds of issues that kids are bringing to school. So if a teacher's having a problem with something that's non-academic, they have that community organization, thus supported by the local CIS organization on my far right, and our state office, who's responsible. As I said, we go to the district and say, give us the teachers, give us the building, and turn the school over to us, and let us work with those students and those teachers. We're building a holistic approach for dealing with both the cognitive, the non-cognitive, as well as those non-academic barriers that kids are facing, and then ultimately using the community, parents, volunteers as the foundation. And my part, as I close out, 7 years later, I was telling Elizabeth, we came here 7 years ago, went to the U.S. Department of Education. We had this great idea called a Performance Learning Center. And they said, come back a few years later. When you're research-based, you have more data to support what you have. And so now, you can see here, we've been listed on the as one of strong evidence and effectiveness for being a great program. And Gary Chapman will talk more about the research that's been done by a third party validating this initiative. So again, Reginald Beatty with Communities and Schools of Georgia, I want to thank you for this opportunity as I pass it on to Denita Cullen, who's one of our principals, who really can talk more about the practical pieces of operating the Performance Learning Center. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm going to talk to you a little bit this morning about what a PLC looks like on the ground. The practical side of the PLC, and I'm going to try to paint a picture for you as far as what it looks like. One of the things that's most important about the PLC is that we do have a small student-to-teacher ratio. At my particular site, we have a maximum of 75 students, and so our ratio is 1-15. That's a lot different than the traditional high school in Georgia, where we have, normally our class sizes are about 30 students per one teacher. So that's one of the huge differences between your traditional high school and your Performance Learning Center. Another thing about the Performance Learning Center is that that Performance Learning Centers are normally separate from your traditional high school. So we're not just part of a building at the regular high school. For my particular site, we are actually on the campus of West Central Technical College. So the students are able to start to see what it looks like to be on a college campus. But our facility is totally separate, so it allows a little more opportunity for us to personalize our instruction for our students. Also, they're not singled out from the regular high school, and there's not all those stigmas attached to them not attending the traditional high school. Another thing that's important is that our teachers are actually referred to as learning facilitators. One thing I do want to point out is that all of our teachers are highly qualified. They are not the throwaways that couldn't get a job at the regular high school. As a matter of fact, all of us came from traditional high schools, and it was a choice. I was at a traditional high school. This opportunity opened up, and it was perfect. So our teachers act as learning facilitators, which means that they're not standing in front of the classroom doing your traditional lecture. They're actually just guiding the students through individualized learning at their own pace. The teachers love it. The other thing is that we have a strong implementation of technology. Our program is computer-based, and we do use an online curriculum for part of our coursework, but we do have offline assignments to make sure that we're meeting all the standards that are required for each course. Another thing is that we do have an emphasis on non-academic activities. As Reggie was speaking earlier about if teachers are teaching, who's dealing with all these other things? Well, a learning facilitator has to be able to definitely multitask because we do look at those other factors. So we're able to act as learning facilitators, but they also do help with things like senior project, which I'll talk about in a minute, which helps students prepare for their career. We talk about study skills and just making good choices. So we do have an emphasis on non-academic activities. Finally, your Performance Learning Center often is a melting pot for all of your high schools in the county. For example, our county has 4 traditional high schools. And if you come to the Performance Learning Center in Douglas County, you don't know which student goes to what high school, because we accept students from all 4 of the high schools as long as they meet that minimum basic skills assessment of being able to read and do math computation on an 8th grade level and pass some other criteria, then they can come in. So a Performance Learning Center will normally reflect all of the high schools in your community. Reggie showed this slide a minute ago, talks about the Performance Learning Center framework, and I'm going to quickly go through and tell you how we support each one of those pillars. The first one is a professional training environment, and what our students have to do is that they have to not only pass a basic skills assessment, but they also have to interview with us before they're accepted into the program. The reason for that is because we know that our expectations are higher than at the regular high school in many cases. For example, they have to master a concept before they move on in their curriculum, meaning that they have to pass their assessments with 80% accuracy in order to move on. So we need to know that they're going to be serious about this. Another thing is we require them to come to school a minimum of 95% of the time. They can't have a lot of absences, which means that that translates to they can be absent 3 times per semester. If that's a doctor's appointment, a dentist appointment, whatever, you get 3 times. And then you have to start making your time up. So you have to spend time with me during lunch, or in the morning, or after school, whenever you choose. But we want them to start thinking about it like a job. You can't just miss lots of days and think that you're going to be able to stay. So we have them, we're trying to create a professional training environment for them. We also have times where we have them dress for success, which means you have to have something other than jeans and a t-shirt. You can't go to work all the time, although we would like to, but you can't do that. So we want them to have a professional training environment. Another one of the pillars is a self-managed performance track. We have something called a seat waiver in Georgia, which means that the students do not have to be in their class for an entire semester. So what that means is that as they finish one course, I move them to the next course, usually the next day. So what they have to do is they have to be able to manage their time, because they don't have the teacher standing in front of them saying, do this today, do this tomorrow. They have their agenda that's given to them, they have their time that's allotted, and they need to keep moving. Positive school climate. It's very important for us to have the students feel comfortable coming to school. Many of these students had negative experiences at the traditional high school, which is why they came to us in the first place. So my teachers, I tell them all the time, we don't yell. We don't yell at kids. Do you want me to yell at you? And so that's the relationship that we build with them, is it's a positive school climate. It's somewhere where you can come and feel comfortable just being yourself. Another one is high-tech, high-touch curriculum. As I mentioned before, we are very, very largely technology-based. They work on an online curriculum. Many of their textbooks, things like that, are online. They submit papers online. So we're trying to get them used to this high-tech world that we live in now. Post-graduation preparation. Cammie will talk a little bit about her senior project, but what we do is all of our seniors have to complete a senior project, which is they have to complete a research paper based on the career of their interest. They have to create a budget. How much money will you have if you choose this career? And that means you can't spend $500 for clubs. It doesn't work that way. So we're trying to prepare them for life after high school. And then finally, community engagement. It goes back to the communities and schools. If we're expecting the community to support us, we have to encourage our students to also give back to their community. So here's the student roadmap to success, and what this will paint a picture of is how a student gets to graduation after the PLC. The first thing that they have to do is take a basic skills assessment in which they have to perform at an 8th grade level. If a student isn't there, we give them some things to study and they can come and take that assessment again. It's definitely not a one-shot and that's it. Yeah. After they pass that assessment, they do have to complete an application. And once again, we want the students that want to be there, not the ones that someone told them they have to be there, but they have to be willing to do the work and raise the expectations. They interview with the faculty, and that's when we talk to them and their parents, or a caring adult. Even if their parents aren't in the picture, we want to know that there's a caring adult that's going to help us help them reach their goals. Once they're accepted into the program, we do something called an IDP, and that's when we talk to the student more in depth about their career goals, where they want to go to school, what their weaknesses are, what their strengths are, and we help them to plan their individualized plan for the remainder of their time at the Performance Learning Center. A couple of other things, we have a mentor program, and that's also another aspect of communities and schools that we have in Douglas County, where we try to match each student with a mentor that they have similar interests. We don't just say, here, you mentor this student, but we want them to have something to talk about. Our instructional day, our students work on two classes at a time at our Performance Learning Center, but we have flexibility within all of the centers. The thing is that we're able to make adjustments to our schedules based on our students' needs. But once again, they do work at their own pace. Scheduling, there's flexibility in that. Like I said, if a student finishes a course, I put them in the next course the next day. They don't have to sit and wait. So they're able to move through multiple classes in a semester instead of just being stuck on one schedule. A capstone project in college readiness, once again, that's helping them decide what they want to do after they finish high school. And then, most importantly, graduation. And we have two graduation ceremonies. We have a December graduation ceremony that's just for our Performance Learning Center students, which is pretty special. And then we have the ceremony in May where they graduate with all of their regular high school classmates. Quickly, the PLC curriculum, once again, it's online. We have about half our curriculum is online. Our teachers also use supplemental materials to make sure that we're meeting all of the standards required for that course. Project-based learning, what this helps them do is connect what they're learning in class to the real world. Charting for Success in College Transitions, that's a program that we do in the mornings, and we just help them with life skills, interview skills, preparing for college, things of that nature. Academic service learning, for example, in our science class, they have a greenhouse that they take care of in the back of the school, and that's helping them learn about horticulture and things like that. What they do at the end of the year is that they then take those flowers and the things that they grow, and they donate them to local nursing homes, shelters, things like that. Senior projects, that's where the students have to do a research paper, they have to meet with someone that's in that career field, and then finally they do a presentation about their career. And either they say, yes, I do want to do this, or no, I don't. Either way, they're figuring out an idea about what they want to do after high school. Internships and dual enrollment, once again, we are on the campus of West Central Technical College. So our students are able to dually enroll, which means that they can take college courses while they're still enrolled in high school and get dual credit for that. So that's helping these students that at one point didn't even think about going to college. Now they're getting a taste of that and pursuing college after graduation. Test preparation, we do in-depth preparation because in Georgia, in order to earn a high school diploma, you also have to pass sections of the graduation test. So we don't want them to just earn a course credit. We want them to earn a diploma. And then supplemental curriculum, we have things like USM Test Prep, Rosetta Stone, that helps our students earn all their requirements for foreign languages and anything else that they need. Quick data on the Douglas County Performance Learning Center. Since we opened in 2006-2007, we have graduated 106 students, and these were students that for one reason or another were not expected to graduate, so that's great. In the spring 2008, for AYP purposes, the high schools have to score extremely well on the math sections of the graduation test and on the language arts section. In spring 2008, all of the students at the Performance Learning Center that took the math portion of the graduation test passed. So that was wonderful because it helped not only our graduation rate, but it helped them make AYP. In the spring 2009, which was just a few months ago, all of the students that took the writing test, which is another required test to get a diploma, passed. So So we're excited about our pass rate on that. And most importantly, our students do maintain an average of 95% daily attendance, and we actually won an award for that last year for having the highest average daily attendance throughout the CIS network. So I've talked to you quite a bit about what we look like, but I think that the most important thing is for you to actually hear from one of my graduates. Kim Hunt graduated in December 2008 from the Performance Learning Center in Douglas County, and I'm going to let her talk to you about kind of her journey before the PLC, during the PLC, and then what she's doing now. So here's Kim.
Before I came to the PLC, I didn't have one of the greatest kind of lives. I went to Alexander High School in Douglas County in Georgia, and my attendance rate was not good. I attended school about one day a week, basically. I was failing every class, and I never failed before. I never had lower than a B. So my student average was quite high. And my family life was not going so well. I was suffering from my father abusing me, so I was conquering over that, and then I got mixed up in the wrong kind of crowd with the wrong kind of people, and nobody seemed to care. So one day I come to school to check in tardy, like I normally did, and one of the office clerks had actually told me that she doesn't know why I even come, that I should just drop out. So I did that same thing. That day, I walked right out of that office and I went and got my dropout forms and turned them in. And I told my teachers that I was currently going to class with that I was dropping out. And they looked at my, they knew who I was, and I was not a dropout at all. But so they had decided to call my mother and get a conference going on. And they told my mother about the PLC. And I knew about the PLC because other of my friends had attended it, but it was not anything in my mind because nobody seemed to care. So I signed up to go to the PLC. I had to pass the BASI test, which I got over an eighth grade score. And then I had to go through an interview and prove that I was worthy of going to high school and getting my high school diploma, and that I was worthy of being there. So they had taken me in, and during the Performance Learning Center, you have many things that you have to do. You have service learning, which I tutor a few kids in school, and then I have my senior projects, and that helps you focus on your career and what you want to do in life. And I decided that through my experience in life, I wanted to be a probation officer because I had known many kids that had gone through the same thing I did, and was getting charged with runaways and such, and that was not how it should really go. So I had had a mentor that was a probation officer, and I looked into it, and I had many hours with her and all the juveniles, and I decided that that might have not been the greatest thing, because a lot of kids are not in my shoes. There are a lot of little heathens out there, so it was not the greatest thing. And I finally graduated in December of 08, and I decided to major in criminal justice and be a police officer. And I'm starting in June. I'm enrolled in West Central Technical College and plan on getting my 2-year degree and then continuing on with the police academy. But the PLC is needed in the school system. It's very needed because there are kids that have good lives but just get off track. And there's teachers at their base high school who just don't care. But at the Performance Learning Center, every single teacher cares. Every single day, that was the greatest thing about it, is I would walk in and I would be happy to be there. There was never a day that I wanted to skip school and take a trip to Atlanta. I would rather go and see Ms. Coleman's face and have her tell me about me bumming out and how I didn't look professional. So it's definitely worth it, and I really hope that Performance Learning Center will stay in public schools to help kids in my situation or any kind of kids that just need that guidance in life. And they helped me graduate, and I would have been a dropout, which is not who I am. So I'm very happy. And I guess I'm just scared. So thank you.
We really just want to show you a video that was put together by our students at our Kent Performance Learning Center in Washington State, and I think this will give you an even more in-depth view of how
our Performance Learning Center is totally different. The teachers care, everybody knows each other, it's a lot more friendly, it's a better environment. It sounds kind of cheesy, but in a way, everybody in the room when we gather together in the morning is a family. I've made so many friends this year that I would have never even thought that I would be friends with that kind of person. You learn that everybody is a person, not just by the way that they dress and stuff.
Small class sizes also help. Each student has the teacher there all the time who can talk to them instead of 30 people in a classroom. For students who are a little bit behind, students who are ahead can help them catch up.
At my old school, my grades, I was feeling like every class due to attendance, and because I didn't want to be there, or like the teachers, they weren't there to help me, so I just gave up. But now that I'm here, like my grades are so good, people are like, are you serious? That's your report card.
No.
It can't be you. But it is.
My attitude has changed. I had a bad attitude at my old school. Every grade was an F. The only good grade that I had was an A in gym. Now my grades are above C's. And I have no D, no F.
The Performance Learning Center is definitely different than a traditional high school.
The mentors are really helpful because they come in and they talk to you about what you're going to do. And when they get you set up with a mentor, what they do is they ask you what you want to do with your life and where you want to go. And based on that, they find someone in the community. You discuss colleges that are an option. You actually keep in touch with them almost on a daily basis, and they just help you out with what you're going to do with your life.
If there's any problems, like personal problems or anything, they're here to help you through that. If there's some financial problem, Candace is always there to say, hey, let's try and get this so you can get on with it. And they work with you.
Performance Learning Center is a new chance in life almost. Once you get here, your slate is clean and you've got a chance to actually get that diploma that you thought was impossible. I know some people who are actually extremely smart, they just didn't make it at a normal school, but they can.
I always wanted to be a nurse, but I could never really see myself doing it just because like I did so bad in school. But now I can see, like, I know that I can do it. And like, I have the confidence in myself that I can do it.
From old school, it was kind of in the back of my mind because I knew I wasn't going to get to that point. So, but now when I come to Performance Learning Center, I am so determined to go to college.
And then once you see that you're doing good, you don't ever want to go back to like, not doing good.
So the technical guy from the technical school doesn't know how to set up the PowerPoint back on the right slide. Okay, so how do our Performance Learning Centers fit into communities and schools in general? Performance Learning Centers are really a proof point for communities and schools. They're a controlled environment where we can really demonstrate the support that CIS provides around integrated student services in an environment where students can learn. Our network is made up of our national office here in Alexandria, 14 state offices. We have 194 affiliates across the country, and we're serving more than 1.2 million students in about 3,200 schools across the country. Our budget for the entire network is $260 million, Of that, about 85% of those dollars are at the local level and then our local affiliates. And of those funds, 70% come from public dollars and 30% from private dollars. Currently, we're implementing performance learning centers in 6 states across the CIS network. Of course, they started in Georgia, and we have 25 schools there. And over the past 2 years, we've opened up an additional 10 sites in other states, including New Jersey, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Washington State. We're also looking to open 3 more schools next year, with additional sites in Richmond, Virginia, Newark, New Jersey, and opening schools in Philadelphia next year as well. Some of the results that we've had across our network. Since 2003, we've graduated over 3,000 students at performance learning centers, and 100% of these kids are students that said that they were dropping out or had already dropped out of school. 82% of our students that were classified as seniors at the beginning of the school year graduated during their time at PLC. For academic improvement, we've had a number of successes that I'll show on the next slide. Around discipline, we've seen a significant decrease in suspensions of our students, and that our students have had 43% fewer absences than at their previous school. Academically, students come into us with failing grades for the most part, and we see about an 80% average while they're at the performance learning center. And we do a survey every year to find out what our kids are thinking about the model that they're part of, and they're telling us that they're accomplishing more, that they feel like they're good students, and that they have developed goals for their future. That the teachers care about them. I think that's what you heard Cammy say, is that every teacher in that building cared about me, and that made the difference. And then students are more focused on their schoolwork. At the end of last school year, we had 76% of our students that were graduating or either promoted to the next grade level. And again, these are students that had dropped out or were to drop out. Plans after graduation, we see that about 64% of our students go on to post-secondary education in one form or another, whether that's technical school, community college, or even four-year college. And across the country, we have students that, although you can't see all these names, these are all the universities, colleges, and tech schools that we have across the country where our students are now represented among their enrollment. So Reggie talked about the results that we've had and that we've conducted an evaluation. And through an external evaluation with ICF, we've been able to do a number of things and employ multiple methodologies. We've done a district level quasi-experimental study, and we've compared graduation rates and dropout rates from school districts with performance learning centers to school districts without PLCs in Georgia. We've done a survey of students and staff to find out and gauge the fidelity of the PLC model, and we've also conducted case studies at 2 PLC sites to really look at what are the elements that are having effects on student outcomes. We've had a number of key findings in this study that was recently published. We found that tutoring and academic assistance and life skills are the key services that ensure the students will stay in school and excel academically. That our model is effective. We've been able to demonstrate that facilitated self-paced instruction, individualized attention, and the strong connection between community, the PLC, and the students is relating to our effectiveness. And that these areas are considered to increase on-time graduation and result in increased student aspirations focused on both continuing their education and expanding the career options. The hedgehog for CIS is the CIS site coordinator, and in PLC that's called the services coordinator. That's the person that's in the building that we've all been talking about that demonstrates and really works with students around their non-academic challenges. And according to the study, we find that they are a key driver to success at the school, and without that person being part of the team, that the PLC cannot cover the necessary responsibilities and meet the needs of students. And that our model is cost-effective, that when you compare the peer pupil cost of the PLC model to the traditional schools, we can demonstrate that PLCs operate at the same or similar levels of expenditure. We've also been able to demonstrate that graduation rates in matched PLC districts increased through this 2 years of implementation and finding that is significant within our schools. We've been able to see an increase of over 6 percentage points to the comparison districts in Georgia that have performance learning centers. And I think this is something that, something just really to highlight is that the efforts appear to have been large district, that we have large district effects on student graduation rates and dropout rates, and a finding that is surprising because we're only enrolling approximately 75 to 80 students in these districts at a time. And that apparent reasons for this outcome are that we're centered in the non-traditional environment, and that our instruction is self-directed, and that the environment is very student-centered. So how does this fit into CIS in general and the model that we have throughout the country? This just kind of lays out for you what the service provision is within communities and schools. But for us, we must have an active engagement in the school and have a school-based site coordinator in CIS that's represented in the school. They were doing comprehensive school and student needs assessments to find out what the needs are of students and as a whole for the school, what are the things that we can provide around those non-academic challenges. We want to identify service partners to meet those needs in the community, and we want to plan for effective implementation of prevention services for a school in general as a whole, and also for intervention services with students that are most in need. And then we want to deliver services and evaluate how well that we're doing within that school and if we need to modify our services in any way. So Reggie talked about this early on. Danita also brought it up that in addition to classroom-based reform, schools have to ensure that there is a definable range of community-based integrated student services that are provided throughout their school. And that it's these integrated student services that allow the school and the district officials to focus on energies that are central to classroom learning, while we can bring in the partnerships in order to serve the non-academic challenges. So it's partnerships like CIS, with years of experience and expertise, but also additional resources that come into the school that allow the school to really focus on education and learning for students. We're supporting a number of bills right now that are out there, and I know that Phil's going to talk about these later, but the ones that we're really focusing on now are the Keep and Pace Act, and the Graduation Promise Act, and the Graduates Act. So those are the three bills that Phil's going to talk about. Around evaluation, not only have we been conducting an evaluation about the Performance Learning Center, but we've been looking into our role as CIS and the CIS model throughout the country. We're in the middle of a 5-year evaluation study, external evaluation with the same organization, ICF, and you can find out a lot more about our study back there on that table. What we've really been able to prove is that we're one of the few organizations in the country that have proven results to increase graduation rates, and that we can demonstrate those. Communities and Schools is also part of the Alternative High School Initiative. This is an initiative that the Gates Foundation has put together with the 12 organizations that it is funded to provide non-traditional school environments across the country. And within CIS, you know, we're a network of 35 schools and of course growing. But within the Alternative High School Initiative, we're almost 300 schools in these organizations that are serving kids in environments similar to ours. All of the models that are represented within AHSI have 5 common elements to them. And so they center around authentic learning, teaching, and performance assessment, personalized school culture, shared leadership and responsibility. We really want to have a lot of student voice in the work that we're doing, supportive partnerships, and a focus on the students' futures. So that we're not only graduating kids, but we're getting them ready for college and helping to support them as they matriculate through. This is just a list of the organizations that are part of the Alternative High School Initiative. And again, there's 12 of us, and I know that National League of Cities is also in the room. I think I saw Marjorie in the back. So we have a number of organizations that are really trying to promote and increase access for students in non-traditional environments. And I think at this time, Phillip's going to go up and talk more about the advocacy work.
Actually, there are probably a number of questions and answers for the four of you, and I just want to thank you again, all four of you, for traveling up here and giving us such a concrete picture of what this looks like, of how it was developed and how it works and how successful it can be. It is really an inspiring, exciting story, and I hope that everyone here who's working in any sort of policy capacity feels the obligation to do whatever we can to support this work and advance it. I'd like to just ask a couple of questions to get things started, and then we'll turn to the audience to ask some questions. But I was wondering, you talked about the 5 common characteristics of the AHSI schools, for example, and we know that there are a number of other organizations out there that have developed replicable, effective, non-traditional models for school student success. But a particular unique trait of the PLC model seems to be the connection to communities and schools. and the deeper connection to the community in terms of providing the full range of supports that students might need beyond academic support. And I just wonder if any or all of the four of you might want to comment on where, what role you think that plays in the success of this model.
Thanks, Peter. From the state perspective, as we began to look at a community-based organization, and this is when I first started out, when we were starting schools, and we hired teachers and educators and social workers and others to build the model, we realized that even though we were building schools, there was still the foundation, and that was that community-based organization, because if we didn't have that, even though we were doing some things inside the building, a non-traditional approach, we still, if not for some community-based organization, would have been missing the foundation, and that is bringing the community into the school. And so from my perspective, at the state, without that, I think there would still been a big hole in going out getting mentors. So we have someone out in the community that's integrating or bringing in or brokering all those services while everybody else can focus on the students in the school, and then we coordinate, systematize, bring those in an integrated way inside the school. So a community-based approach, from my perspective, I think whether it's at the local level, at the state level, or nationally, if we don't take that approach, then we'll continue to just have schools throwing stones, being responsible as opposed to looking at the entire, the school is part of the community. And if we look at it as the school is part of the community, and the community is responsible for the school, we believe that approach will be better served and we'll have all of us in this together as opposed to saying the school is separated from the community. So from my perspective, I don't think that you can separate school from the community because the school is part of the community and our students and their parents and everyone else, we're all out there in the community, whether it's latest legislators, clergy or whoever, it's just part of the community. And if we take that approach, I think if we all say that we're responsible and not principals and superintendents and teachers, it's community that's responsible, I think we'll be better served by having more kids stay in school and graduate.
Anyone else care to comment? If not, I have another question. So I'm wondering, you all have worked in a number of districts in Georgia and increasingly are expanding into other states, and I just wonder if you can comment on district and or state policies that are particularly helpful in launching PLCs or that are problematic in terms of launching PLCs.
I think that Janita mentioned the seat time waivers, and those are really important for our schools. We've had a number of states that we're now working in that don't have that, and so the policies that can be created around seat time waivers and allowing kids to get credit based on competency instead of their cheeks in the seat for 150 days in a semester or 9 days in a semester. I think that's one of the policies that can really help us or hinder us. I think that within a district, the policies around credits and not really following kids as they get into high school and ensuring that they're getting the right credits that they need. We'll have kids that come to us and they are missing, they've got 25 elective credits and they only needed 6, right? And so there was an efficient way for them to get the credits that they needed and get through, but no one was really looking at that. So I think that ensuring that a process is in place that kids are getting what they need and not necessarily all these additional things. Also the linkage of credit to college and making sure that students are reaching, they're getting the credit they need in order to get into college. That's also important, that there's a seamless approach to how students get those credits when they're transferring between numerous districts. I think that policies around that would be extremely helpful.
I think we also, from a policy perspective, if we have, and I know a lot of districts are moving, a lot of states are moving to having a one diploma. But if a ninth grader who may not have a supportive structure around them and say, you need to be on a college preparation track, but yet a ninth grader who may not have that insight or have the support around them say, I want to take the easier course. I don't want to take 4 math classes. So you're telling me I can graduate and just take 3 math classes versus 4? A ninth grader that's 14 years old is going to take that easier route. So why would we allow them to make those kind of choices, even though they may decide to go to a technical college? Because what we find is a lot of stuff, 17 and 18-year-olds say, I wish I had not made that mistake in the ninth grade, but now I want to go on to college, but yet they may be credit deficient because they haven't taken the required courses to enroll. So the synchronizing college and high school and what credits require, because you can graduate from high school but yet not have the right courses to get to college. I mean, that makes no sense. So those two institutions need to be synchronized as well.
I think that's a great point. I mean, it sounds, struck as one of the things that Tammy said, really pretty much evidence of pushing out by adults in the building. So I think, to your point, that there really need to be structures in place and individuals in place that encourage the best decisions for the long run for students. And there are ways to incentivize that policy-wise, not just leaving up people doing the right things. I'd like to open it now to questions. We have microphones on either side of the room. If you could please identify yourself before you ask your question, that would be helpful.
I'm always first and I can never reach the microphone. First of all, I hope we get a chance to hear Philip, because I know that he was going to give us an update on some of the legislation. My name is Myrna Mandlowitz, and I represent the School Social Work Association and the National Alliance for Pupil Services Organizations. I want to applaud you. I think this sounds like an incredible model, and working with kids like Hammy, who, congratulations, sounds like you're doing great, who have not fared well in traditional high schools. So one question I have, since I represent school social workers, and I know, Gary, I see that you have an MSW, that there was no mention of school-employed providers, school counselors, school social workers, school psychologists, and other ancillary personnel, we call them specialized instructional support personnel, in your buildings. And while teachers sound like they're very well trained and are filling in, I think we've asked a lot of a teacher to be able to fill in those roles that they aren't traditionally trained in to do through professional development. So if you could comment on how those folks might be used in your schools.
We have, like I mentioned, we have students that come from all four of the base high schools. And so what I've done is built a relationship with the school counselors at each one of those four high schools, as well as the social workers. So that is a relationship where, because I'm not a social worker, I'm not a trained one, definitely. But if I have a concern, especially with an abuse case, there have been situations where I've had to file a report, but to make sure that I was doing everything properly. As far as following protocol, it was very easy for me to call one of the school social workers, and they walked me through that process. In another situation where a student was cutting her arm, and I was able to call a school social worker, and they came over. I said, this is not a phone conversation. I need you to come over. So in our district, we don't have someone that's stationed in our building, but that relationship is there, that all I have to do is pick up the phone. And if one is in their office, because we have four high schools, I can call somebody else. So they're not, they don't say, for example, if Cammy needed something, they won't say, well, I'm not assigned to Cammy's high school. If that social worker isn't available, or if that counselor isn't available, then I just go down the line and call someone else. So luckily, we do have that support system, and I definitely don't try to take on that role, and the teachers don't either.
And I would say that before I came to the national office, I was the principal of one of our schools, and the social workers and the counselors were where the majority of the referrals came from for our school. So they had identified students that were most in need in the traditional high schools, and even sometimes in eighth grade, they weren't going to make it to high school, and they were referred to us. We were also, as CIS, our role is to coordinate the service delivery within the school. So it's the services coordinator's role to make sure that there are connections with the school social workers in the district, and that the services that are provided to students as a district as a whole are also brought over to the Performance Learning Center. So they're very engaged. It's just within our model, we have that one person whose role is to coordinate those services, whether or not it's from district employees or it's from community partners, mental health agencies, and the like. And so all of them are funneled through that one person in the school.
So before we take any more questions, I apologize. I got so caught up in the presentation and the discussion about the PLCs that I went straight to Q&A. And we do first want to hear from Philip, and then we will open it up to Q&A. We are very pleased to have Philip Lovell here from First Focus. He is the VP for Education, Housing, and Youth Development there. An important organization doing critical advocacy work on behalf of children. We're really pleased to have the opportunity to work with First Focus and look forward to Philip's comments about the policy implications of the work that we've heard about at CIS and PLCs. Thanks, Philip.
Well, I too wasn't just engaged in the conversation, so no worries at all. I'm Philip Lovell with First Focus, our organization. For those of you who don't know, we're not a contact lens company, as the name might suggest. Our purpose is to have kids be the first focus of federal policy and budget decisions. And can folks hear me? Because I can stand up. Okay, great. To me, the good news that we're hearing about the PLC and CIS tells us that we don't have to live in a country where only 7 out of 10 kids graduate on time and where graduation for our minority students is about a 50-50 proposition, that there are answers. This is one of them. There are many. But there are replicable ways that that we can make sure that we achieve the goal that President Obama set forth in his address to the Congress back in January, that once again America will have the world's largest proportion of college graduates. It's a bold goal by 2020. Who wants to see that happen? And with the work of CIS and others, we can achieve that. I think that what makes PLCs and what makes CIS unique, and why I'm such a fan of them, is because of their comprehensive approach. So with education policy, I think that broadly speaking, I know I'm oversimplifying things a bit here, but there's the camp that focuses on rigor and accountability, and then there's a camp in the discussion that focuses on the needs that kids bring with them into school. And CIS and PLCs are successful because they don't see a dichotomy between the two. They bring both conversations together. And they show that we can improve academic achievement by meeting the needs that kids have in their lives, and that if we don't look at children as children and the lives that they lead and the needs that they have, that we do so at the peril of their academic achievement. And CIS, to me, if you remember one number out of this hour and a half of our session this morning, remember this: 3.5. Not only is it the age of my little girl, who today, for the first time, wore big girl underpants to school today. So her grandmother emailed us back and said, thank you, well, me too. But 3.5, the CIS PLCs, their graduation rate over the 2 year, baseline up to 2 years, their graduation rate increased 3.5 times than the percentage points that the other school districts did. And again, they were successful in doing so because of this comprehensive approach. I want to take just a quick moment to underscore the role that non-academic factors play in academic achievement, because I think that to some it sounds soft, but it's extraordinarily real. One issue that I've been focusing quite a bit of attention on is around student mobility. At the worst end of student mobility, you have children who are homeless. Over a decade ago, the Government Accountability Office did a study of student mobility and found that 1 in 6 third graders had moved schools 3 times by the third grade. Telling me that those kids are on the trajectory to graduating from high school, I don't think so. They looked into their performance and found that those kids were 1.5 times more likely to be below grade level in reading. They're twice as likely to be below grade level in math. They're 2.5 times more likely to repeat a grade. And as Gary was saying, Reggie was saying, when kids repeat a grade, they're all that much more likely to not graduate from high school. Let's look at the summer learning gap. We heard about it a lot. There's some good research out there that I haven't seen as much in the airwaves. Researchers from Johns Hopkins show that two-thirds of the achievement gap between our low-income and upper-income students actually come from summer learning loss, from differences in learning opportunities during the summertime. So the achievement gap is there in first grade, and it sort of levels during the school year, and then it gets bigger and bigger and bigger during the summertime. So that by kids in the ninth grade, they're already so far behind that on-time graduation becomes less and less of a likely scenario. Student health is another huge issue. I won't go into as many details, but there's some research that's published jointly by Brookings and by Princeton University that attributes almost a quarter of the achievement gap, the racial achievement gap, to differences in child-rearing and health issues. So just looking at, you know, at mobility, at summer learning, at health issues, it's unfair and, dare I say, it's dangerous for us to simply expect schools to shoulder the challenge of graduating all of our students on time, ready for college, and ready to be in the competitive workplace that we need them to be in. The good news about the PLCs is that they're not alone. The collaborative network that was mentioned that Gates is funding, the Alternative High School Initiative, in that collaboration, about 260 high schools, which is great, but there are 16,000 high schools in the country, 2,000 of which create half the nation's dropout. We have this number, it should be imprinted in all of our brains thanks to the work of the Alliance. So we're not nearly to scale, and frankly, there are very few targeted interventions that have the research, the evaluation behind them that CIS brings to the table and that PLCs bring to the table. And that's one of the most important things to think about this initiative is that not only are the interventions based in research, but the outcomes are evaluated and it shows that it works. But let's listen to what's actually working. The CIS strategy is extraordinarily comprehensive. Rooted in it is quality instruction. There's a personalized learning environment. The instruction is self-engaging. They use service learning. They use internships. They have intentional partnerships with the community. They capitalize on the resources that are in schools, the social workers that Werner was mentioning. They have their eye on the prize. They're targeted towards the future, towards college, towards not just high school graduation, but towards college attendance and towards a career. And their strategy is all based on relationships. They wouldn't see, I don't think, the commitment to just for the young people to be there, the drop in tardiness, the drop in absences, the drop in suspensions and expulsions that we saw from an average of 7 per child per student to just above 1. I mean, that's huge. They wouldn't see that, I think, if it wasn't for focus on relationships. And how do you legislate relationships? Well, you don't. You can't legislate relationships, but policy can provide levers to facilitate the type of environments and the type of relationships between schools and communities that can produce those types of relationships in schools. So among the policies out there, the proposals that would do this, I'd like to highlight the Secondary School Innovation Fund the Alliance has been championing. It's the Graduate Act Take 2. It'll be introduced by the Senate Majority Leader. Always nice to have the Majority Leader's support, along with Congressman Dave Loebsack on the House side. And this legislation would authorize $500 million a year to expanding promising approaches for high school innovation and evaluating. And so that we can start by bringing them somewhat to scale, but then really bring them to scale when we have better research on what's worked. The Graduation Promise Act, another piece of legislation that the Alliance has really championed. This bill hasn't yet been introduced in Congress, but it provides $2.5 billion annually for secondary school reform, for high school reform, targeting those dollars towards the high schools that need it most. It sets up a structure to identify high schools that are in need of additional support and then the resources to help to turn them around. What I like about this bill isn't just that it's necessary money, and we all know that money is necessary. It's not just that it provides a structure and system for improvement, but the improvement that it calls for is itself comprehensive. So it looks at things like curricula, and it also looks at things like community partnerships to bring in the resources into schools and to work with the folks that are in the schools, the social workers, the school psychologists, the school nurses, to really provide for that wholesome environment that our kids need. Some other pieces of legislation that I'd like to mention. Senator Kennedy has introduced a bill called the Keeping Pace Act, the Keeping Parents and Communities Engaged Act. This legislation was introduced in the last Congress. It provides a new funding stream for really three areas. One for parent and community engagement coordinators to be housed in school districts to promote parent and community engagement, as the name of the coordinators in the bill might suggest. There's also money in that legislation for community-based organizations to bring in services into schools, and then there's money in the bill to renovate schools so that they're more used as centers of the community. Another bill that was that's been introduced and that'll be reintroduced here shortly is called the Full Service Community Schools Act. This bill was introduced by the House Majority Leader and provides funding for school districts and schools that partner with a community-based organization to bring in services into schools, at least three services into schools. Then there's a third bill that's called the We Care Act. I love acronyms in the city. It stands for Working to Encourage Community Action and Responsibility in Education Act. And this bill says that while we need new programs for this, that we also need to look at Title I policy to see how can we bring together schools and communities, and how can we really embed it in the SEA plans and the LEA plans and the plans for school-wide Title I programs and whatnot. And there's more information on those bills on the back of the table. The administration theoretically will at some point in the relatively near future propose its principles for the NCLB reauthorization. And we have a pretty good sense of what those principles will look like in that and how we've seen things go for roughly the first 100 days in the language that's in the stimulus package around the sort of the four priority areas that states will need to perform on in order to get the rest of their stimulus money and to qualify for the Race to the Top fund. So we know the administration is prioritizing high-quality teachers and a better distribution of high-quality teachers. We know that they are caring about, we all need to be caring about strengthening standards, rigor in the classroom, and we know that we all should be caring about data-driven decision-making, and they want to have an emphasis on low-performing schools to have those four pillars. I think that what we learned from CIS and from PLCs is that there really needs to be a fifth element to these four priorities, and that is community responsibility. The president's talked a lot about parental responsibility. Teachers can't turn off the televisions at home. Parents need to turn off the television at home. Parents need to reach their children. Structurally, what we can do in terms of policy is really facilitate the interaction between schools, school districts, and communities that can really help to bring in parents into the schools and to strengthen parent involvement too. But policy today really hasn't done a very good job of facilitating strong interactions between schools and communities. We know there's a hunger out there for it. There was a $5 million earmark that the House Majority Leader was able to secure for full-service community schools. There were 400 applications, and 10 got funded. So we know that we know how it works. CIS proves that it can work. And again, I want to go back to some of the data on the need. A couple of years ago, the American Promise Alliance commissioned a study of essentially the presence of CIS terms, the five basics. Do young people have caring adults, safe places, access to health care, an effective education, and a chance to give back? Research shows in its various forms that if kids have these five things, that they're much more likely to be successful in school and after school. What the study found was that only about 30% of kids had four or five of these things, and about 10 million kids, 20% of the nation's 6 to 17-year-olds, had zero or one. We're not on the trajectory for success, but by leveraging the opportunities that communities offer with the academics that schools offer, we can wrap literally the love, the attention, and the rigor that our kids need to be successful for the competitive workforce that that we all know is upon us.
Thank you, Philip, for that very thoughtful overview of both the federal policy landscape. Appreciate you talking both about existing programs like community schools, funding that's out there now, as well as legislative proposals that are out there to dramatically increase the federal support that's available to replicate, continue to evaluate, and continue to develop other non-traditional models of schools and ways to improve low-performing schools for the nation's most at-risk students. At this point, I will really turn it back over to you all for questions. So if you'll make your ways to the mic, and I'll just alternate sides of the room. So,
hi, my name is David McDuffie. I'm known as the Pond Master. I'm here representing a few community organizations. We teach chess to students, theater to students, and we infuse life skills. So chess is resource management, strategy, decision making, theater is role playing, conflict resolution. The making of videos is a technical skill. I'm not hearing that type of meshing of programs, although, you know, we can have that where it's student self-paced. I'm wondering how you have that in your curriculum, if you do.
We don't teach chess, but we do on a daily basis try to work on those life skills. For example, with the attendance, it's not my whole thing whenever they're absent, and when I say that they can miss up to 3 days, mm-hmm. and then they have to make up their time. The whole purpose of that is you have a job to do. And so they're not in there necessarily serving detention with me. They're working on their work. And while they're doing that, we're talking about, okay, do you know why you're in here? Yes, Ms. Cohen. Because if you have a real job, what happens if you don't go to work? I get fired. You want me to fire you? No, Ms. Cohen. So we're building life skills that way. Also, it's funny because our building is very small, and our math teacher is also our PE teacher, meaning that during lunch, every day, these boys, and sometimes the girls too, they're out there throwing the football or playing basketball, but what it's teaching them is that there's a time to work and there's a time to play. And if you don't do your work during those two and a half hours, then you can't go outside and play football. So we are infusing those life skills as far as technology when we're talking to them about doing their senior project presentations. You create a PowerPoint. They have to do all of that. Don't put a whole lot of words on the PowerPoint. So we are infusing it in different ways, just on a daily basis. Everything that we do is related to the real world. Attendance, how you dress, how you interact with others. It doesn't matter if you don't like each other. You have to work with each other. It doesn't matter if you don't like me. You have to work with me. So we may not have necessarily chess and the technical things, because our focus is still primarily academic, but we do infuse those life skills pretty much in everything we do.
Let me also add that it was very deliberate and intentional. A lot of our students were coming to us. They already maxed out on some other extracurricular kinds of activities. But for the most part, these students were overage, undercredited, not online. And so we took a look when we designed it and say, we have this many hours in a day. We would love to do all these other things, but the reality was we need to get these students back to so they can see what they need to do. We would have loved if we were starting and getting that child from the very beginning in the ninth grade and didn't have all those other things we were dealing with. We would have institutionalized some other activities, but we don't have football teams and baseball teams and basketball and cheerleading and all those other things because you had a chance and you've done those things in the ninth grade and taking physical education and all those other things. But the reality is, we know they are necessary, but our kids were coming to us so far behind, and so we had to use this time to say, okay, we We got to get you back where you need to be, moving on that path. So it wasn't that we didn't think about it. It's just that we knew we didn't have the time to try to get them where they were and then get them where they need to be. And so we made the choice. And not, as she mentioned, informally we do some of those things, but formally we don't.
I would just one more comment on that. In our schools, we do see those things happening in a number of ways. One is through the internships and the job shadowing experiences. And so, I mean, our whole model is really built on student interest and what they want to do. So as part of their senior projects, as part of their internships, if they're interested in theater or they're interested in those things, we're connecting them with mentors in the community so that they can get that experience. So we have many students that are doing web design, many students that are engaged in community theater, or might, as part of one of our service learning projects, work with other students to bring maybe a play or something into elementary schools or primary schools in their community. So there are other ways that we infuse those things. It's just not something that we set up as an intentional nature, as Reggie said.
Well, and I would say that I think that in part of the benefit of having stronger relationships between schools and communities is that you can bring more of those opportunities into schools. So I have my daughter, who I know and love, and you guys, if you knew her, you'd love her too. 3 and a half, she's going to, when she, the kindergarten she's going to be going to when she's 5, they have the chance for these kids to start taking piano or to start taking violin. Now, my daughter's 3 and a half, and that's when she's 5, and I'm already thinking about this, which shows that I'm slightly manic about my kids. But it's also that, you know, she's going to be going to a private school. A whole bunch of reasons why she's not going to public school. Actually, she's really one because she's too young to go to public school by 4 days, so we had to find a private school for her to go to. All that is to say that my kid, she's going to this, you know, relatively special school. She has a chance to take violin and piano, and not every kid does. And that's ridiculous. And we need to change that, and I think by having strong relationships between schools and communities, we can identify folks in the community who are willing to volunteer time to teach kids how to play guitar, to do more art classes and whatnot. Because kids have to feel like they're successful before they are going to open a book or even sit down with the math worksheets and really feel confident that they can do that stuff. So it sounds like I'd love a book video.
Hi, I'm Bob Tate with NEA. I'd like to thank all of you for terrific presentations and congratulations on your outstanding work. I have two questions. The first is, to what extent do you permit or encourage adaptation or variability of the basic principles of the model in different programs that are part of the network? The second question is, among, say, in Georgia or nationally, among the 40% or so of students who are entering ninth grade and not graduating, about what portion are able to pass the basic skills and interview test criteria to get into the program versus those who can't. Thanks.
I'll take the second question. In terms of the students that we had to interview to meet the eighth grade reading level, when we first started out, we accepted every student. Our two pilot sites, we accepted every student based on love. Come to us, we love you, and we'll love you to pass all the graduation tests and get on down the road. Well, I start going in and analyzing, why aren't these students passing lessons and getting credits and et cetera up to the first semester? And I realize something is wrong. We got great teachers, we got all this support. What's going on? So after we started the school, we instituted this basic assessment skills inventory, and I found that I had two schools with 150 students, and a third of them were reading on a second and third grade reading level. And we realized that this model is not a catch-all for everybody and everything. And so we had to go back, refer some of those students to GED programs, and go in and decide early on, I said, we got to do this assessment to realize, because even though we want to help every child, this model is not for all. So to answer your question, we had to interview 150 kids to get 75 to 100 that were reading on the eighth grade, and then we would take, and so I said we would take some on a 6.5, because if they're motivated and maybe there was something wrong or they're testing or whatever. So short answer, A third of the kids were not reading on an eighth grade reading level, and we know we've been doing a disservice to the child with this particular model. But it didn't mean we couldn't refer them to other initiatives and other programs. But we knew that 17 and 18 year olds that were reading on a third, fourth, fifth grade, sixth grade reading level, the model would not be able to serve them. And we know we didn't design it for everybody, but for a certain population.
I would say, regarding question one, as long as the core elements of the pillars that you saw are in place in the school, there's a lot of flexibility in how they implement that, particularly in the classroom. So teachers set up pacing guides for all of their classes where they would say, here are the things that I know are important for you to learn and to master in order to get your U.S. history credit. So if they have found videos or they have found proven practices from their previous experience, they can incorporate those into their curriculum. We have our online curriculum as a foundation to make sure that kids are meeting the standards that they need. And so they're filling in the gaps around that, or they're replacing pieces of that curriculum with things that they know are have worked for them in the past for their students.
Hi, I'm Eve Brooks, and for the last 10 years, I've worked in Washington, D.C. with 50 charter schools, and two safe schools, healthy students grants. So what you're talking about today is, of course, very close to my experience, as is the experience of working in a community, a poor community in D.C., trying to build quality services. One of the questions, having looked at evidence-based practices and how they've evolved, and the recent study of the National Academy of Sciences on mental health services, is how do we integrate what we're learning from these other evidence-based works and applications with the work of the community schools approach that you've taken? How do we do that in legislation so that we're using Title I more effectively? How do we do it in our own work with communities to make sure that the services that we're bringing into schools actually are high quality? Complicated question, I know.
Question.
Yeah, if we have another 4 or 5 hours, we could do all that. No, thank you. I would say that for us, that's where the communities and schools as the affiliate in a local community really plays into this, because they are connecting and bringing all those partners together, and then looking at ways within the district to utilize Title I funding or other funding that is part of the district already, and creating those relationships to get the services going in the school. So, you know, we have on all of our boards locally, we have a 40-60% split on our board, which means that 60% of the folks on our board have to be from the private sector and 40% have to be from the public sector. So we're really trying to put resources together for the community and then be able to look at what the best examples and the best practices are from those organizations and bring them into the multiple schools that an affiliate, a CIS affiliate, is working with in a district. So I think it just takes a lot of coordination, of course, to do that. And many of our schools have started through charter school. Well, not many. We have 3 of our PLCs that are charter schools. We also have a number of CIS communities that have started through Safe and Drug-Free Community Money or Safe Schools, Healthy Students Money as a way to start a school and then build a community approach into many other elements in that school.
Gary, when you all go into communities and you're looking at the range of services that are available and pairing that with the needs of the student, do you find that most of the organizations that have services to offer do have some evaluation or evidence base about their effectiveness?
I would say that some of them do, some of them don't, and of course, if they don't, then we're looking at how can we support that. Our affiliate in Chicago, CIS of Chicago, they do a lot around that, where they work with programs that have effectiveness and have demonstrated that, but they're also working, because there's so many partners, to help the partners that don't have that evaluation data to start pulling some of that together. And so they might go into a school and say, we'll help you get into the school for a year, but we want to help you evaluate what your services are doing and if they're, proven practices.
Does anyone else want to comment on that question?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, just first on the evaluation point, I think that we just need a lot more of it. And, if you go to the WellWorks Clearing House, there aren't a whole lot of things up there. Some people might, say that their standards are a bit high. But if you go to, there's a new youth website where they have it's something about youth.gov. I should know it by heart, but I can't make it right now. They take what's in the Works Clearinghouse and a couple other sources, and they show, you know, if you're based on the degree of evidence that's been associated with the program, that it's promising versus proven, regardless of sort of where a specific intervention is on the trajectory. I think it's safe to say that we would all benefit by knowing a whole lot more. And if nothing else, knowing more will theoretically help us to get a lot more money, which is really necessary to expand these things. But in addition to, I mean, it's not just a matter of money, we need good policy, and so I appreciate you bringing up the City Schools Healthy Students program. It's about a $100 million program, but structurally it requires agreements between the chief law enforcement officer, the chief mental health officer, and the school district. So structurally, coordination is required. I think we need a lot more of that federal policy, and some of the bills that, that we mentioned would help to do that. But you know, if you're talking to congressional staff, the people who deal with mental health are usually not the people who deal with education. They're certainly not the people who deal with housing, and they're not the people who deal with physical health. Our committees are set up to deal with, and even though there's the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, for example. Health is by and large handled by the Finance Committee. Medicare, Medicaid is under Finance. SCHIP is under Finance. And then Education is under Health. So there's very little intersection between the two. And I was actually recently at a session with the Senate Majority Leader and brought up the idea of joint hearings between the committees so that we can have a real conversation about the comprehensive needs of kids that, you know, they don't fit into the congressional committee structure. It just is. And you talked about just how hard it would be to do that given the egos involved. And that's an unfortunate circumstance, and hopefully by making the voices a lot more, making our voices heard, we can break through that barrier.
I just want to add a comment that the work with the multi-agency approach of the Safe Schools, where it's worked, we've got some very strong models that we're using here in D.C., have worked very well in New York State, and we think we could take elsewhere at this point. When you bring that together, you really have full reach, as we do now with the mayor's office here, into the various pots of money at the state and community level. And so I think that discussion really is ready to go to another level, and be glad to help you with it.
Thank you for making that point. It's helpful. Thank you, Bill.
Hi, I'm Christina Weider with the National Youth Employment Coalition. And first, I'd like to thank Amy for joining us, because too often at these kinds of events, we don't have a youth voice here to give us the youth perspective. So I just appreciate that today. My question is about, the barriers that were put up on the screen. Those are definitely barriers that are in rural communities too. And many times when we talk about the dropout crisis and dropout factories, we tend to think about urban communities. And some of the models that have been held up nationally, like the Harlem Children's Zone is a model to replicate, is very much an urban initiative. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how this model might look a little bit different in rural communities to just address these same barriers. Kind of have a different angle.
It's interesting that you would say that. The majority of our performance learning centers in Georgia are in rural communities. And we have performance learning centers in rural communities that only have one high school, or two traditional high schools. And those performance learning centers are helping the traditional high school make AYP. And so whatever the challenges, barriers, even though they may look a little different in an urban versus the rural, we're still dealing with teen pregnancy and all the other risk factors of kids not being turned on to school. Maybe they're a little different in terms of some of the risk factors, but the reality is we are seeing success with the model at the high school in rural communities, suburban communities, as well as urban communities. And we haven't changed the model to accommodate a community. We just take a bullseye approach
on whatever the challenges and concerns are and deal with those, whatever they may be. But the model is working extremely well in our rural communities.
Yeah, I would say I'm from South Georgia, very rural South Georgia. That's where the Performance Learning Center that I implemented was. And because we were dealing with the right kids from that home high school and bringing them into this, we made AYP 4 years in a row. And I mean, that was something that I think it's like 10% of districts in Georgia do. You know, because we were working with that the right kids from those groups. I would say nationally within CIS, about 40% of our CIS affiliates are in rural communities. So it's not a model that's urban or rural or suburban, but we're able to really do this across the country in a number of different ways.
Thank you. That's a really important question and something that the Alliance is focused on, is making sure that we draw not just from best practice and research in urban areas, but in rural as well. So thank you for bringing that point up. Next question.
Susan Frost with the National Middle School Association, also with Scholastic Publishing and in their education division. This is a question I ask in a lot of forums because of who I represent. Your eighth grade cutoff, essentially, or admission standards. Thank you for pointing out that a third of the students that you interview cannot make that standard, and that is the problem that we're facing, and it's also the problem of making AYP, obviously. The third of our students aren't making the reading and math standards, they're not going to a third of our students aren't going to graduate, et cetera, et cetera. In looking at how you would, right, from your perspective, and this has been very helpful, tackle grades 5 through 8, right, and the students that you're seeing. And Cammie, I'd like your perspective on this as well. Would you infuse the components of your performance learning centers into your middle grade feeders? Would you do a type of performance learning center even at the middle grades? How would you advise us to tackle this? And Phil, how would you work into your federal policy the success of the Middle Act that we are about to reintroduce in May?
The first part about the middle grades, we actually know if we can get the students earlier, then we probably, let's hope we can alleviate the need for performance learning centers. But we made a conscious choice of the short-term gratification and how when you look at success and results, people want to see graduation right away. And even though we wanted to go into middle school because we knew that we really need to get the kids early, we also knew that for funding and support and results, we need to show the results with the model first. And so now we're going back looking at, we're in the process of having what we call a middle school model in Georgia, which is called Life and Learning Academies. And it is very, very, the intent here is when you do a lot of the social kinds of things at the middle school grade levels, and we work with a lot of young boys and a lot of young girls, we felt that we need to continue with the relational and what we're doing and having kids buy into and the relevance of education and building life skills. That component of it, we will continue in the Life and Learning Academy at the middle school, but the curriculum and the way the instructions, we didn't feel that our students who are still faced with all those risk factors will have the maturation on the maturity level to be able to be self-paced and individualized. So when we look at our middle school model, we're not going to take that self-paced, individualized component with us. But all the other stay-in-school and support around them, et cetera, we're going to bring all of that in the middle school model. And we're still designing how the curriculum, and there will be extra reading, there will be extra math. Instead of one reading and one math, you'll be in there 2 hours and two in math, so we can really get that infusion of math and reading score. Because, again, so many of our kids at the high school are failing the graduation test, and in Georgia at the middle school, so many of our middle school kids are failing the CRCT. And so we continue with that process, and they're not reading and they don't understand math. We just felt we need to have a heavy, heavy infusion of more. And the other thing, we are looking at it from, it may get me in a little trouble, we are looking at it from a gender base, not the whole school, but the classroom, math, English, science, social studies, and the boys over here, and the girls over here because of all those things that they're dealing with. But for physical education and for the lunchroom, for socialization and et cetera, arts and those other things, we're going to combine them. But for the core curriculum, we are looking at separating, and that's a major difference in the Life and Learning Academy, which we're in the process of developing at the middle school level.
Terrific.
terrific. I hope you can come back when you're further along on that. Give us the report on how you're doing.
Thank you.
We'll see you in a few years.
Well, I think that a middle school PLC would help out a lot, actually, but because of the fact that I remember middle school and it's so social that you do not even care about learning, and so many kids, it would really help, and I would have really learned a whole lot if there would have been a middle school PLC, because the short time that I was at PLC, I learned more than going to 3 years in a public school, which is sad because I was not prepared for college and I'm still not prepared. So I have to learn what I should have learned in middle school and high school from the public school. Like, it would help, but there would have to be more, like Reggie said, half the girls on one side and half the boys on the other, because it's so, you're just more focused in on who's hooking up with who and anything but. And so many kids in eighth grade, that was the main problem in high school, was because in Georgia, if you fail your eighth grade science class, you're going to take it over in ninth grade, which sets you back a science in high school, which doesn't help you. It doesn't help you in college. I thankfully passed it, but I didn't know that. I had no idea that it would affect me in high school and my future. So I just wish that there would have been some kind of opportunity like this in middle school.
I mean, just briefly, Community Schools is also involved in a pilot right now with City Year and with Johns Hopkins for a whole school, middle school model, where we're infusing the CIS model, the team teaching that goes on in middle grades, and national service to provide these supports for students and a whole school model, and how we do that within a feeder pattern. So it's the multiple middle schools in that feeder pattern that are leading into, you know, these one or two high schools. And so that's something that we just started, and we're piloting it in Feltonville Middle School in Philadelphia.
I can tell we have incredible interest in talking with these presenters, which I completely understand. I think in the interest of time, we're only going to be able to take one more question. I would encourage you to please stay and see if you can get a moment to ask your questions directly to the presenters, and know that they'll accommodate you to the extent that you can. Sorry we don't have time for everybody, but you can go ahead and ask our last question.
Tanika Young, graduation coach with Communities and Schools of the Nation's Capital. I was going to ask, once in cities or states where you already have alternative high school models, how is the PLC perceived and received by the school districts in the communities, as well as at the local schools? This is for Mrs. Cullen. How is parental involvement look from the admissions process all the way up to the graduation for the students at your school?
Okay, well, the first question, I was a graduation coach too before I became the academic coordinator, but the perception of the PLC in Douglas County, we had to work at that, because once again, when you talk about alternative school, people thought that we were for the kids that got kicked out of the regular high school. And we had to definitely work on that and make sure that people understood that this was not the school where you got in a fight and you got sent over here, or you cursed out your teacher, you got sent over here. That wasn't what we were. So we did have to work to change the perception of our center. We also had parents that when their students brought home this application saying, I want to apply to PLC, I had parents say, no, you can't. As a matter of fact, I just interviewed someone last week that she was behind last school year, and she's still behind. But because of the perception, her father would not let her complete the application last semester. So once we began to get recognition from the awards that we won, then they ran articles in the newspaper. Then they said, wait a minute, this is a good thing. So that young lady and her dad came back, because now she's still behind, but now she wants to get into the program. So it's all about perception. At the local schools, it was the same thing. It's very important to make sure that when you have any type of alternative school program, that the local schools are aware of what's going on and what type of students you accept.
my relationship with the principals, I go to all of the principals' meetings, so we talk regularly. As a matter of fact, one of the principals called me yesterday on my cell phone. He said, "Where are you? I need this kid to get into your program right now." And so I said, "Well, I'm not there." He said, "Well, can you get back to take care of it?" But they will call me on my cell phone to say, "Hey, I need this kid over there. This kid is a good kid, but they're not going to make it in my 2,000 student high school." So that relationship is very important, and making sure that the staff works to make corrections. If they're in the grocery store, wherever they may be, make sure that people know we're not for necessarily the bad kids. Your child will be safe here. They can come here, and even if they don't have discipline problems, they can still come to our program. So,
thank you.
Anyone
else want to comment? Okay. I'd now like to invite the President of the Alliance for Excellent Education, Governor Bob Weisel, for some closing comments.
Thank you. Thank you to our incredible panel for coming from Georgia. And to Cammy, I'd like to say thank you, because Washington, where we are right now, is about, and actually just about three blocks away, is about policies and what should, and the policies that will affect millions. And then the policies should be based upon what are good practices, that such as performance learning centers. But you go from the practice to the, from the policy to the practice, and ultimately it's all about the person and people. And you've illustrated very well the impact of policies far away, what it can mean in one person's life. But one person by one person by one person, and pretty soon we've got a nation. And so I want to thank everybody for being here. I also want to thank the Carnegie Corporation in New York for making it possible for us to hold this forum. The video of this will be online very shortly on our website, as well as materials. And also, I would ask you to remember the evaluation form in your packet. Now, we've learned about an innovative mechanism, the Performance Learning Center. We've also learned something else that's critically important, is that there are examples like PLCs that are working right now in districts across the country that are making a difference. And so the key is, as I went from the Washington, from the policy to the person, let's now go from the person to the policy. Because what's critical is to take what is working for one person and then working for 500 and working for 100,000 across perhaps 20 school districts, and to turn it to work for 6 million most at-risk children between the ages of grade 7 to 12. And so that's what PLCs do where they work, and that's what we have to make sure that we can leverage through federal policy. Arne Duncan, Secretary of Education, talks about the race to the top funds. I want to challenge us all to, this in the next 2 years, to go over the top, to put over the top measures that will make possible performance learning centers, measures that will make possible graduation promise acts that Philip Lovell mentioned, measures that will make possible, for instance, innovation funds, the measures that will truly put into place a permanent mechanism so that we can do something, that we can come back and celebrate, if somebody asks, true gains for our students. And so we have this opportunity in the next 2 years to make that difference. And I just want to thank you all from the Performance Learning Centers and from communities and schools for being such a vital part in communicating from the person to the practice, and let's make it policy. Thank you very much.